I'm Wendy Damon Dante, and I'm here to welcome you to this session 278, titled Mormon Mind Game, Common Mormon Thinking Errors. And this is scripted but not rehearsed, so I'll see how I can do here. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. I think that means don't look at your phone during the session. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you're taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books. And also please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors who sell books by academics, I guess. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. After this session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger. I just looked up the menu online, so you can do that. I decided it wasn't for me, but a Utah tradition. I'm going to go to the healthier place over here. But anyway, join with your real friends and go to Crown Burger. Please return on time for our plenary, is that how you say it, pronounce that, session with Linda K. Klein, I think. Oh, who will be speaking on the parallels between the evangelical and Mormon purity movements. Seats will fill up quickly. About the presentation. Every culture, organization, religion, and person, and I think this is the same as is in the program, experiences thinking errors, which are commonly called cognitive distortions. Cognitive distortion can cause individuals to perceive reality inaccurately, producing and reinforcing negative thoughts and emotions. This session will build off of the popular session, Mormon Thinking Errors, which addressed typical ways myth and overgeneralizations present themselves in our LDS families and church settings. This session will take the conversation further and offer concrete strategies to combat the cognitive distortions we are personally experiencing and how to address them internally as well as in our interactions with family and friends. And then the presenters' bios. Jennifer White is a therapist who specializes in helping people with depression, anxiety, sexuality concerns, trauma, and faith transitions and journeys. Sarah Hughes-Zabawa is a licensed clinical social worker, wellness coach, and yoga instructor who specializes in treating trauma, depression, and anxiety. She often works with LGBT plus individuals and their families to foster acceptance and promote advocacy skills, as well as with individuals and couples experiencing life transitions related to their faith. Lisa Butterworth is a licensed professional counselor who specializes in faith transitions, mixed faith marriage, and sexual concerns. She is the founder of Feminist Mormon Housewives and likes to play nerdy board games with her husband and three kids. After the presenters, oh, that's my note to myself. I can tell you that there'll be a lengthy time for, I don't know, nerdy board games and some kind of interactive stuff, it sounds like, and questions answer. So I think they'll present for approximately, 55 minutes or something, and then about a half an hour we'll be participating in the presentation.
Well, thank you for being here. We're so glad you're here. And I think before we start, I would just like to express some gratitude to our Jennifer, this is her baby presentation. She has done this for multiple years, and there's been multiple variations from it. And so her permission in allowing us to be with her in this work is, we just want to thanks, Jen, for allowing us to do this with you. Also, it's going to be really boring if we don't have some participation. So we invite questions throughout, not just at the end. So please be as lively as you can after a really long day, right? Anyone else need some caffeine? No judgment of your choice of caffeine. What are cognitive distortions? So we are peculiar people, but we are not unique. Every individual, family, culture perpetuates distorted thinking patterns, including Mormonism. I would ask you, as Americans, have you ever had some possibly distorted thinking about your success versus other nations, right? Do you have any family mottos that might not be very healthy, right? Like, when we think about Mormonism compared to our Jehovah Witness brothers and sisters, there's some real comparisons in some of the narratives that have shaped their belief, their thinking, right? Similar to our, like, we're just not that unique, right? I just want to make sure that wherever you are in your belief spectrum, you recognize our cognitive distortions that can be specific or have a Mormon flavor does not mean that other people, other religions, other cultures don't have similar ones to themselves. It's a part of living, breathing, and being a part of a people, if that's part of a marriage, if that's part of a family, a religion, or a culture. So what do we mean when we say cognitive distortions? Quick definition, they are thinking errors, are the different ways our mind convinces us of something when there isn't really true, or, if that word true feels a little bit too tender, a lot of evidence in support of.
And I just want to normalize a couple of things. First of all, we all have thinking errors. Even with all the training I've had in cognitive behavioral therapy, every day I'm using these. I'm quite good at them. And there doesn't need to be any judgment. This is about just noticing and recognizing it. But it really is important to look at how we're thinking, and that really does affect our feelings. And I very much come from a framework where I believe all feelings are valid. So we don't need to judge ourselves for whatever we're feeling. You know, often I used to kind of grow up and be like, oh, I'm bad, I'm feeling angry. But let's get curious about our emotions and what are they telling us? And they are valid. What is the thinking and beliefs behind that? And maybe challenge that.
So if you could pull out your cognitive distortions paper, and if you don't have one, we have someone that can hand them out to you. I want you to get curious about what are your favorites. Boy, do I have favorites. Tony, I think we have someone behind who needs one. Lisa, do you want to go over some of the examples?
All right. So, magnification and minimization, right? So, magnification is that thing that happens when we perhaps say the wrong thing, or we say something that, you know, later we're going over in our head and we think, oh, nobody's ever going to love me again. I said the wrong thing in that one space, that one person, or, you know, like it just becomes so big. And minimization is kind of the opposite, where maybe we had a really big feeling or something really hurt us, and we'll say to ourselves, oh, that doesn't really matter. I shouldn't care about that. Or, you know, not paying attention to how big it actually felt, right? And then catastrophizing is one of my favorite cognitive distortions, where it's like, oh, this is the end of the world. The worst thing possible is going to happen. Okay, so overgeneralization is just making a drastic interpretation of the text. You know, if someone says something to you like, oh, this is a good one. Oh, we didn't see you in church last week, right? We can sometimes, like, believe then after that, like, oh, she was judging me, now everybody's judging me, and I'm always going to be judged, right? And maybe she was judging you, but that doesn't necessarily mean everybody's judging you or that you're always going to be judged. Magical thinking is, you know, I got married in the temple. My husband shouldn't have a mental illness, or he, you know, like, we shouldn't be struggling like this, or we shouldn't be thinking about divorce, or, you know, like, if I did the right thing, if I followed the rules, then only good things should happen to me after that. Personalization. One of the ones that I think is really common, especially for Mormon women, is it's my job to make everybody happy. And if everybody's not happy, I've failed at my job. Right? I'm a failure because people are feeling sad or whatever. Jumping to conclusions. I mean, that's kind of obvious, right? Like, without necessarily gathering more information, we decide that we know what that means. We decide we know what they meant by that. Sometimes one form of this is thinking we can read people's minds. Like, oh, she must be hating me, or he must be judging me. When we haven't gathered more information, we didn't talk to them about it, we're not necessarily basing it on anything that we know. Fortune telling is, you know, just predicting what the future is going to look like without necessarily gathering information. And emotional reasoning, the assumption that emotions reflect the ways that we really feel. That our emotions are the way things really are, right? Like, when we're feeling something, the feeling is, and the thing about this cognitive distortion is I feel like there's actually no other kind of reasoning. Like, let me just say, emotional reasoning is the only kind of reasoning we can do. Like, the idea that we can be logical outside of our emotional context is false. We always have an emotional context, and it's always going to be affecting our reasoning. Always. But the key is to recognize the emotion that is affecting our reasoning, right? Like, we can't remove emotion for our reasoning, but we can recognize if it's anger or if it's shame or if it's, and recognize that that is affecting our reasoning.
Yeah. First, this happens a lot with, like, self-defeating beliefs. Like, if we're saying, like, oh, I'm feeling bad, so I must be bad, that isn't very helpful, and that would be a thinking error. Yeah, and then disqualifying the positive. This is one I'm great at. Ever, like, you know, you're working really hard and doing all this stuff, and then you get some feedback and that opportunity for growth, and what do you focus on? You know, your feedback of what you did wrong, and that can definitely affect us in negative ways. Should statements. This is something that I think we've seen in a lot of cultures, including my own, Mormonism. When we are constantly telling ourselves, oh, I should be doing this and that, and, you know, focusing on everything we're not doing instead of what we're doing. So anytime you find yourself saying should too much about yourself, we might need to be a little more gentle with ourselves. At least I need that advice. All or nothing thinking. So this can be, or black or white in thinking. This is perfectionism. I'm really good at this one. So sometimes we'll take one event and just kind of make it go to the extreme. So, for example, when I was in grad school and the first test I took that was like a really hard test and I didn't do well on it, I got so overwhelmed and I was like, I'm going to fail grad school. I'm never going to get through this. So I'm just kind of applying it to like everything and not putting in perspective. And actually what helped me that day was using some of the principles we're going to talk about today that got me out of that. Self-blame or other blame. And so often we'll kind of tend to go to one or the other, maybe blaming ourselves for everything, thinking we're, you know, accountable for things that we don't really have control over. Yeah, we need to own our part in things, But we have to recognize that we're in systems and not overdo that. As well as sometimes I see other blame, not wanting to take any responsibility. So both of those things are things to get curious about. Blaming the victim. Now, this is something I see often just in society at large, particularly, I mean, around some hard topics. Oh, like if someone is going through something hard or like rape, you know, well, what was she wearing? What was she doing? And definitely a thinking error. I think this comes from a place of wanting to really feel safe in the world. And if we, you know, these bad things maybe won't happen to us if we are able to do these things. So I don't think we're not bad for like maybe going to those things. But yeah, it's not always safe.
Denial, right, is the complete absence of recognizing what is in front of us, which is also a cognitive distortion. We're not looking at evidence or truth. And so as a distortion or a thinking error, we're pretending that it's not there, even though it's there, like the elephant in the room when your child leaves the church, right? Or the elephant in the room in your marriage. Or the reality that something has shifted within you, maybe even your own spiritual faith and awakening, and yet you're not wanting to name it, talk about it, and recognize that it's impacting your mental health, right? Denial shows up in all of us, typically when we're not ready to look at it yet. And yet staying there for a long period of time can definitely show up as dysfunction. Labeling. Oh, labeling. Right? We want to not look at the whole of a situation. Let's label something and minimize it. Oh, he's an apostate. Oh, they're a brainwashed believer. Right? It is labeling someone and minimizing the whole so we can not have to look at the entirety, which is a distortion of the truth. So first, I just want you to think within yourself if you have a favorite cognitive distortion. I have mine. Do you know yours? Right? Usually if you're throwing a party in your head that's really self-critical or where you go with the shame, blame, or self-deprecation, that is an insight in that you have a cognitive distortion showing up somewhere. Should we open up to the audience and ask, before we give examples of cognitive distortions within a Mormon framework, what some of your favorite ones are?
Said in the blame the victim idea, how many times are you sitting in a lesson and it gets brought up, people that leave the church, and it's people often want to put them in a box. Well, they were sinning, they were not far in enough, like that whole stupid analogy about the bed and don't fall out of the bed, and or whatever. But I actually have always recognized that as like they're trying to make themselves feel safe. Well, this won't happen to me or my loved one if we do A, B, and C. I actually never noticed it to the rape thing because that drives me crazy when people say stupid stuff like that. But.
The all or nothing thinking, when you said that, my first thought went to politics. Back in regards to the war on terror, the president said, you're either with us or you're against us, with no acknowledgement of any in-between or neutral parties or conflicted parties. But something about Mormons, that one also comes up some in the church, when people say you're in the church or you're not, and don't acknowledge the cafeteria Mormons or the struggling Mormons as something that can exist in a reasonable world.
I always struggle with that one with my clients because a lot of my clients, I feel like I have to answer this question two or three times a day. Are you Mormon, right? Because what they're asking is like, am I Orthodox? Am I going to church? Am I doing all the things on the checklist, right? And I don't feel like the labeling thing. Like, I don't know that I fit into those labels easily. And so I feel like if I say no, I wouldn't be telling the truth. If I say yes, I wouldn't be telling the truth because it's so much more complex for me. But we don't like make a lot of space for that.
I second the all or nothing. That's and I kind of pair that with emotional reasoning and disqualifying the positives. They all kind of fit together for me. But I remember if something bad happened, as routine as a car repair, and this isn't the church's fault necessarily. When you combine personality with church culture, you know, I'm just not one where those gel. But I immediately thought, well, did we pay a full tithing? And if we didn't, our life was garbage because of it. And so I find parallels with those three that I just mentioned, the all or nothing emotional and disqualifying the positives. It sucks, by the way.
Oh, I was just going to say the magical thinking as well, with thinking that tithing is going to be a magic trick.
They make us feel like that. But it just never happens like that.
I would say with the catastrophizing as well, I was talking to a mutual family member, and someone that we are aware of recently went through a divorce, and someone said, well, what happened? And, well, first they left the church, and then they had an affair. Like, those are connected. And I just didn't say anything because I couldn't, like, deal with that in that moment. But I think a lot of people that are so black and white thinking then jump to the over generalization or even catastrophizing. Like, if you don't check all the check boxes, your spouse is going to be unfaithful. Does that make sense?
And what if it's a right decision for someone to get a divorce? Like, they get their right decision.
And from a believing perspective, on the opposite, right? If I leave the church, then everything in my life is going to be easier, right? Like, there's this narrative, right, that we take our, guess what? We take our cognitive distortions with us sometimes, wherever we go on the spectrum. And so sometimes that perfectionism, right, that lives in the fear of not being loved or belonged, which can definitely be magnified within an orthodox space of check boxes for worthiness, that still desire to be loved or the fear of not being loved or enough can follow in any area that you go if it's not addressed at the core, right? So I just want to make sure that we're, sometimes when we think about cognitive distortions, we think, oh, if we leave Mormonism, our cognitive distortions go away. Some of them are challenged. Some of them might be lessened depending on our mental health and its relationship to culture. But guess what? Our thinking still follows with us. So we still need to address it within our belief, within our disbelief. So I think that's where we need to really stay grounded too.
In fact, I mean, of course, this applies to politics, but whether you're watching Fox News, MSNBC, NPR, CNN, you're going to hear thinking errors. And so just recognizing we all have them.
Yeah, I was going to say, from a more faithful perspective, one of the ways that these thinking errors that I sometimes see in clients is, I'll have a mixed orientation or a mixed faith couple come in, and one who is left will have that, like, everything's great, everything was better for me since I left the church, I'm so much happier. Meanwhile, their spouse is really, really grieving. And because they are sort of in that same thinking of error of, I need to, like, have this perfect, like, I need to have this perfect image of my life is so much better now, right? Like, there's, like, they feel like this inability to, like, see their spouse's pain and to have that affect them. Does that make sense? Right, like, if my spouse is hurting and all I can say is my life is so much better, that can sound really unkind, right? Like, you're hurting, but I'm so happy and everything's perfect over here. Anyway.
Also, when we talk about cognitive distortions, we do things for a reason. So sometimes our distortions are there to protect us. Right? And so sometimes when we see other people and their cognitive distortions, we want to rip those away. Right? But I think sometimes we need to recognize the service that those are doing for others with some grace that they do for ourselves, right? So the most we can do is be aware of our own. So for example, magical thinking. Some people might think the belief that you see someone in the afterlife, that's magical thinking. You have no proof of that. Yet that belief can keep someone incredibly healthy and well in a loss. Right? So when we think about thoughts and feelings are always valid, I want you to think, does this belief serve me? Does it keep me healthy? Does it keep me balanced? Because that can be so different for each person. And I want to make sure that sometimes what we view as a distortion in someone else isn't, because it is keeping them well. It is keeping them balanced. And so I know that's kind of tricky and feels a little bit ironic, but I think it just brings back to what are ours, how are you aware of them, and then getting clear about the ones that are common in our culture so we can be more aware and more thoughtful about them.
So why do the thinking errors matter? Because our thinking is connected to what we feel and then how we behave with others, right? So there is no way of separating out like the thoughts that are going through our heads from the ways that we are going to behave in our lives, right? Like we the things that we focus on and think about become the things that motivate us and drive us and move us. And if we are thinking about things in ways that are distorted, that aren't clear, that aren't awakened or whatever, then it can often lead us in ways that aren't meeting our needs, right? And in the end, the more clearly that we can think about and see our emotional responses to things, the more that we can move in a direction that will actually meet our needs rather than, you know, sort of meet the sort of cultural narratives that we have maybe learned through the cognitive distortions. If we learn how to challenge our stinking thinking, we can alter our feelings and moods and behaviors. And so there's a ton of research on this cognitive behavioral therapy, that when you can change the way you think about something, you can change the way you feel about it. And so it can be really powerful. You can go at it about it the other direction too. but this is one method that is highly successful. And if it works for you, go for it. So these cognitive distortions, you know, like if they go unchecked, if we believe them, if they feel true to us, because I think we're better at noticing that our emotions are changing and maybe not true, or like that they're contextual or they're happening in the moment. I think we're better at that often than we are at noticing that our thoughts might be contextual. Our thoughts might be, you know, like a product of what just happened. And yeah, our thoughts are just as changeable as our feelings, right? And so noticing that our thoughts, what our thoughts are doing, is a really important key element in moving ourselves in the direction where we are becoming whole and kind to ourselves and feeling like we are fully accepting who we are.
Yeah, and with this diagram, I'm going to kind of like restate that in a little bit of a different way. So our thoughts affect our emotions and our behaviors. There's this relationship, huge relationship with all of them. Of course, how we're feeling is going to affect how we're thinking and how we behave. And then our behaviors have a huge effect on our thoughts and our emotions. But if we just kind of focus on our emotions in the sense of, I feel like I've heard so many times from people, well-meaning, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, but saying, oh, well, just stop being depressed or stop feeling bad. Oh, there's no reason for that. Oh, you don't need to grieve that. It's not really helpful. I don't know really how to just stop feeling what I'm feeling. But what I do know how to do is to learn from it and to kind of notice what thoughts I'm having and reframe those. And that is a much easier way to kind of get in a better place. And it's okay if it takes time. It's okay to sit in our emotions. We just don't want to get stuck with them.
And from a holistic perspective, working on these, for example, if I'm really thinking nobody likes me, what does what feelings immediately arise, right? I'm sad. I'm probably going to be a little self-conscious. I might be anxious, right? And as a result, what is going to show up in my body? I'm going to probably do bodily behaviors that shut me down, that make me not look at other people, that are my heart palpitation increases, right? And as a result, that behavior is going to isolate me, right? If I'm really feeling like no one likes me and I'm experiencing that thought at a party, my body and my behavior is going to also perpetuate that belief, because no one's going to approach me collapsed. No one's going to approach me if I'm really anxious or I can't make conversation. So when we have these negative unchecked thought distortions, because I have no evidence that nobody likes me, right? Unfortunately, those cognitive distortions start perpetuating themselves, right? So I isolate myself at the party because I think nobody likes me, but then I have more evidence that nobody likes me because my body and my mind responded as well as my behavior that fueled that cycle. And so this can get very tricky within cultural Mormonism. So we're going to go there. Did you want to do this one, sure, Lisa? So look at the difference in this experience, if this is the thought.
So if we change that thought of nobody likes me to, you know what, I have a few friends I can really trust, right? Like, usually then what we experience in our body is more of a sense of peace, a sense of connectedness, maybe some heart opening, right? Like, when we tell that story, that feels good. And so, and it's so important to know that this is rooted in our body, because every decision we make is rooted in a bodily sensation. And the thoughts we have can create those sensations. So if you tell yourself nobody, you know, right, we already said that. So then you open up, right? Like, oh, I have a few people that I can trust in my life. I have some places where I am loved. That feels good. And then we open up. And then maybe we want to get out of the house and get some exercise. And then that changes the way our body feels. We walk over to a friend's house and we get some sunshine. And maybe we eat a cookie with them, right? And that feels good. And then that good feeling then creates in our body a sense of, oh, I'm loved, right? And so it starts with the thought, and it goes, and that's way oversimplified, right? Because one of the things, and I don't know if we cover this, but one of the things that happens is the more we have a thought, the more it is, the easier it is to continue to have those thoughts, right? So if you've been thinking a certain thing over and over and over and over again your whole life, that becomes like a superhighway in your brain of thoughts, and it feels super true. The more you have thought a thing, the more it feels like a true thing to you. And the evidence seems self-evident, right? Like, I have so many clients that come in and say, I am unlovable. I am unattractive. No one could love me. And they've been telling themselves this for so many years that it absolutely feels true in their body to them, and that truth feels like this in their body, and they just get smaller and smaller.
I love this example too, because it's not exaggerated, right? It's pretty balanced. I have a few close friends who I can really trust, which for many of us is all we could ever ask for, right? Instead of everyone loves me, right? We often go back to those extreme negatives, right? Nobody likes me, and watch that reaction. But even just a simple balance of, I have a few close friends I can trust, right? That changes our behavior. It changes our bodily response, and it perpetuates a little better balance. It challenges the cognitive distortion. So let's go for probably why you're here. Examples within Mormonism. So raise your hand if you've heard this one. If you're sad, depressed, anxious, or struggling, it is because you haven't repented or you have done something wrong. Or you don't have enough faith, right? There is a deficit model. You haven't prayed enough, right? The shoulda, woulda, couldas, right? You should have been praying more. You should have been more faithful. You should have been more repentant. Like, this is so common, and yet it completely ignores the reality of mental health that, guess what, doesn't discriminate on your religious affiliation or lack thereof, right? So, for examples, what does it include? It includes a huge overgeneralization, a jumping to conclusion, right? We see this in faith crisis. specifically when someone is in that dark night of the soul, everyone sees them really depressed or really grieving or really angry, which is actually just a really natural sign of grief. And yet that jumping to conclusion is, it's because they're sinning. It's because they left the church. And on the reverse cycle, if we see someone happy or in a real season of abundance, what's the cognitive distortion? It's because they're so faithful. It's because they're paying their tithing, right? We're not allowing people in any spectrum of belief to be human and have real human experiences and to have real failures and real successes and real bounty and seasons of complete famine.
So how do you then, even if you are on the spectrum of belief where you see God's hand in your life or blessings or whatever, and you mm-hmm. see that connection, how do you see that connection and not have it be distorted thinking?
So if I'm in a season of abundance and a season of belief,
and you feel like, oh, that's connected, God's blessing me.
That's a really interesting question. Do you want to? I have a few thoughts, and then Jen, do you want to go? One, I think if it's grounded in what is real, right? Like looking at all the facts, like I am both believing that there is an abundant God who gives, right? You can have that belief and also look at, we're working our butt off at work. You know, I am dedicated in showing up and doing this idea, right? Like that isn't, we often minimize all of the skills and strengths we take to an experience to God. Right? So like, let's say you have a really strong marriage and you're like, it's because we go to the temple every week. And that's the only what you're attributing it to. You're also minimizing that you're taking time together, right? That you're probably working on communication or service at the same time, which behaviorally supports a strong marriage, right? So we minimize once. So the opposite of catastrophizing, we minimize other skill sets, other life experiences, what we bring to the table sometimes in the midst of belief and abundance. And yet, can you also believe in a wonderful giving God? I would hope so. But I think where it takes it out of distortion is also looking at the balance of it, coupled with some generosity or some gratitude. I'm really grateful for this moment, knowing that it might not last. But I think what can be so fleeting is when the belief of abundance is only associated to worthiness.
Now, we talk about the thinking errors as if they're individual. And in therapy, of course, you're dealing with one person at a time, so they manifest individually. But they manifest individually because they're socially conditioned. When we tell each other again and again, you'll be blessed if you do everything right, then of course we're going to say, I'm unhappy, so I must not have done everything right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of my thoughts is like, it's so interesting how often, at least it for me, like, I've given credit for anything that's going well to God and blamed myself for anything that's going bad. And I think it's okay to give ourselves credit. I think it's good to give ourselves credit for our strengths and what we're doing well.
And I think every culture to get healthier, either individually or systemically, is to challenge these cognitive distortions. So it's raising your hand when that shows up in Relief Society and saying, well, actually, my mental health is not an indication of spiritual or moral worthiness. And research backs me up, right? I mean, truthfully, right? Like, it's coming back with that really balanced approach of sharing our examples. You're right. So you're also seeing cultural pushback, but with those daggers, if you're still in that space of attendance, you're also going to get people who text you at night that says thank you. Because you know what? My son has severe depression right now. Or do you know what? I'm struggling with bipolar, right? Like, I think the humanness and challenging the cognitive distortion is how the cultural shifts, but you better believe that we have culture that has supported these cognitive distortions or they would not be here.
And you get to take care of yourself first. And if something's going to be harmful for you, then you get to make that decision where you're at. There are places where I'm not emotionally in that state to do that. There's other times I am, but that's so individual. Yeah.
If that's the right choice for you.
Yeah. We don't know.
And for those of you where church attendance is not your jam, is not your healthy place or where you thrive, guess what? You living your best life that will also be human and messy and have seasons of famine and seasons of bounty is also a way to prove that cognitive distortion in other people. Not that that's your responsibility, but I mean, that's the reality, right? And oftentimes we don't get to change how other people show up in their cognitive distortion, only in our own.
Yeah, I was thinking, when you were talking about abundance, I was thinking about the book, The Secret. You ever heard of that book?
Yes.
What do you guys think about that type of philosophy where everything has to be positive and you can't think negative at all? Valid or negative thoughts?
So I have a thing about this.
I'll take the mic up there and I'll give it to people.
Thank you. Lisa has some thoughts and feelings about this. Great question, by the way.
Yes, I love this question. So I think that, like, the secret, I mean, like, if it works for you, I don't want to denigrate it, but I think it has elements that are problematic in that it's really a very privileged position of, you know, believing that if you have positive thoughts, positive things are going to come out. If you're in a position of poverty or being a person in a black body or being somebody in a woman's body, no matter how many positive thoughts you have about your life, you are going to have blockades in your way of, like, being in an abundant life, right? Like, poverty doesn't care how many positive thoughts you have, right? Like, poverty is going to affect your ability to move through this world making the choices you want to make. And so the way that I think about it is that we have the ability to change the way we view the struggles that life is going to present us. But we do not have the ability to think our way positively out of those struggles. Right? Like, and that can make a huge difference. And it's, I think what the Buddha talks about is that, you know, like, we hear this, the Buddha says life is pain, right? But suffering is optional. And pain is a part of living because we are going to lose people we love. Sad things are going to happen to us. Pain is inevitable. Painful things, loss and change are inevitable. Desire is inevitable. But what is not inevitable and unchanging is our ability to interpret what those painful things mean. If we interpret that that painful thing means that I am bad, that I am broken, that I am somehow at fault, then that is suffering, right? Like, that is when the pain of something that is inevitably painful becomes 10 times stronger because I am being blamed for it, I am being held accountable for it, or I am doing something wrong, right? Like, that's where the cognitive distortions make the difference. It can't make the painful things go away, but it can change the way we view the painful things so that they aren't magnified by our thinking.
So I like to use visual imagery for things because it helps me remember. But I had the image of normal things and bad things and suffering that happen in your life is kind of like the arrow that comes at you, but it's the second arrow of whether, depending on your thoughts, so that, oh, because this arrow came and hit me, I must be a bad person. You just inflicted that second arrow upon you. So we have an opportunity to prevent that second arrow depending on how we look at our suffer, look at our trials and our challenges. And I think maybe what The Secret is actually referring to is kind of what we were talking about with, you're at a party, I have no friends. Well, if you're not thinking that and you're smiling, you have positive thoughts, you are going to attract. It's the karma kind of philosophy. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just liked that visual of the preventing that second arrow is our thoughts and a kind of a karma put out, get back thing.
I love that. And I think the invitation of The Secret is to give us the permission and the reminder to think in abundance, right? To give us a benefit of the doubt can soften some of our behaviors and our interactions and our emotions that can perpetuate greater positive experiences just by the belief of those. But to pretend that we don't have negative experiences, which is the next example of cognitive distortion in Mormonism. Who's heard, if you create a faithful home, family home evening, tithing, church attendance, scripture study, seminary, missions, your family will be protected from trials and or danger. Who's heard that? All the tear faces, right? Who's been given that promise? Okay. No one's given that promise, but man, do we hand that out. Bitter and sweet. I wish I heard more bitter and sweet, less. I heard a lot more promises in my experience in Mormonism. I did. I believe, and without a lot of evidence, to be honest. Because one of the things, too, is we show up in our church experience, and are we raising our hand in Relief Society and Men's and talking about the negative things that are happening in our homes? No, we're talking about the things, the beauty, the bounty that came from our effort. So we're seeing a distorted perspective of what is showing up. So we are seeing overgeneralization, magical thinking, personalization, the should statements. We're jumping to a major conclusion when we say X equals Z in every situation, in every family, in every dynamic, right? An overgeneralization, fortune-telling, and all-or-nothing thinking. So if we took a really balanced approach with grace, looking at the evidence, it might sound like this. Religious practices and religious traditions with the family can be individually and collectively supportive and healthy, but they do not guarantee a life without trials, heartache, or unexpected loss, right? Family home evening can have beautiful benefits simply by being together as a family. That is not going to stop an unexpected death. Almost, I'll be right with you, I see your hand. Bad things happen to good people, believing or non-believing. My religious practices can give me strength. They can provide fortification. But they do not prevent challenges or mental health challenges or real illness or cancer. Your thoughts, sir?
So it's interesting how we're taught that we have individual worth. We're taught that, you know, that there is a fair amount of suffering. But then the doublespeak comes in, and there's only one paradigm through which to experience life. For me personally, that ruined my individuality. And so, again, when I bring my personality to a church paradigm, it's kind of it's a little bit gross, but. And my family was a great microcosmic example of the church. We did everything or we did nothing. And, you know, there were negative feelings and you couldn't express those. And I think my parents believed, I'm doing everything. Why aren't my kids happy, or, you know, that type of thing. So I carried it with me. And it's amazing what happens when, basically, the beginning of my journey away was a hard realization that the church is not giving me the tools to deal with my individual problems. And, of course, that opened the door, and the rest is history, but anyway.
I think when the promises fail us, or we have those big realizations that we've done it all, and yet we're either not growing, or we're experiencing incredible heartache, or the narrative on why we're suffering doesn't resonate with our truth, right? That cognitive dissonance, you better believe that it's asking us to shift somewhere, right? And so I'm so glad that you were able to choose within your context to look at what was healthier for you, and that you needed skills elsewhere. Absolutely, and I support that. This one has been one of the ones that has plagued my life. The hardest way to live is the best way. Life is meant to be hard. Put your shoulder to the wheel. Let's talk about your pioneer ancestry. The martyrdom of motherhood, right? That what is good has to be hard, especially as it relates to spirituality and faith. No. Not even in 2 hours. So, right, what is that? That's all or nothing thinking. That's a should statement, 1,000 layers deep. And it might have looked really different in what that meant for your family, what that meant within your religious culture or within your Mormonism. A more rational approach would be, we make thousands and thousands of accommodations in your everyday life to create ease. Who has a washing machine? Our pioneers didn't have a washing machine team. We make ease in every area of our life, right? We pay for it, literally. Aspects of our life can be hard. Cancer is really hard. Divorce is really hard. A child with autism can be really hard. But it's not supposed to be meant simply to survive, right? We're not here just to survive. We've made 1,000 accommodations that we welcome every single day. Who has a smartphone? Right? Who has a car? Did you guys pull your handcart here? No, like we, it's so interesting that within a religious context, we have still kept that it's supposed to be hard, right? And that can be within our belief, within our disbelief, in the full spectrum. We are also meant to have joy. Hard parts of life are normal, but it's also okay to find ways to make it easier. It's okay to go to therapy. It's okay to have a church sabbatical, right? It's okay to set boundaries with your bishop. It's okay not to wear your garments, right? Where are we creating real, incredible tension and pain and martyrdom and suffering for no reason or no evidence that it is for our benefit? It's going back into that eternal sense of authority instead of external sense of authority. And that list was not what I want to put upon you. I want you to just have the invitation to start thinking, what are you stuck in because you're told it's supposed to be hard, and because it's hard, it's good or worthy or better than?
You mentioned their motherhood and the struggles and the joys and the values of motherhood. So I think that sentence is in more somewhat sexist, and it hasn't been a big part of my life. Oh. I've heard it at times, but it hasn't been. So I think women get that a lot more than men, and I'm sorry for anything I contributed to that.
Well, thank you on behalf of all women. Right? But you're right. There is a different narrative of martyrdom in motherhood. It's supposed to be this hard, and you're also supposed to really enjoy it, which is why Julie Diaz-Ovedo's Hank's aspirational shame research is so important within the context of Mormon women. I mean, we honestly do see it's supposed to be hard within our men, within the culture. For example, I worked with a gentleman who is a stake president, right? And he's in his faith deconstruction right now. And he thought the fact that the sacrifice of him being away from his kids and missing all the baseball games and missing all of the huge moments of their upbringing, it was okay because it was hard, and because it was hard if he was serving God. And so now in this stage of his life, he's really sitting with, did it have to be that hard? Right? So I want to make sure that our men are also seen sometimes in the challenges of the patriarchy and what is asked of them because of that discontinuance. And so it's all of us. We are all in this, and we are all hurt by it and limited by it.
I was going to say the other place where I commonly see this notion hurting men is in their sexuality. That, you know, like that their sexuality is often, you know, well, we're asking you to give up all of these things, and we know it's hard, but that's okay because hard things are good, right? And sometimes that is good, right? Like, it really is contextual for every person, but it isn't good just because it's hard.
And we don't need to shame people for having sexual desires.
Our sex therapists are in the house.
Now, these next two are things that can really be helpful for some people. And so these aren't necessarily bad. There's just contexts that they were, for some people, they might not work. This idea that we choose our trials, or everything happens for a reason. And, you know, like, everything happens for a reason. I've seen people where that's really helped them get through things. I've also seen both of these things used as a weapon. I've seen, you know, oh, well, you chose this person to be your mother, so there's a reason. There must be, there's abuse, you know. Like, it's, we see a lot of therapists.
Can you give some other examples, Jen, or can we?
And kind of on the next page, but yeah, because I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've definitely personally have had like some struggles this last year with my health and a lot going on. And I've been so lucky to have a lot of supportive people. And even in some of their best intents, you know, sometimes people will be like, well, you know, there's a reason for this. There, this must be, you know, your fault. This is what you're not doing, you know, and placing that blame without maybe meaning to. But that's so hurtful when you're in the middle of a medical crisis. We don't choose to be sick, you know, and so that's been hard. And I think there, I just like to empower people. We get to make the meaning of what we go through, what that will mean for us, each one of us. We're the authority on our own life. No one else's. And through time, we can figure out what it'll mean for us. But sometimes we're in the middle of it, and someone's telling us, yeah, that's not always fair.
We see this a lot, and I see you, so I will let you speak in just a moment. We see this a lot with loss. If you have lost a child, right, there can be some real healing in the thought that I chose this trial with the caveat that that gives me the empowerment to get through it, right? Or everything happens for a reason. So if my daughter died of leukemia at age 8, and there's a reason for that, that might give me health and wellness and being able to grieve, to move forward, to allow ourselves to surrender. But if that is not a mother's story, and you tell her, everything happens for a reason. And she is absolutely, that is not her meaning. Her meaning is that this was a traumatic loss. She is not okay with it. Cancer's not okay. That she did not choose this and her daughter did not choose this. You can't take away her truth, right? So I think this is how we need to be really tender with each other, that you get to make your meaning related to your religious beliefs or your lack thereof or your spectrum, right? Other people might do that for you with the labeling or the blaming or the victimizing, but you get to make your story and your meaning. That's part of individualization. That's part of differentiation. That is a part of knowing the whole story, which might only be you who knows that.
And I think one of the reasons why people use this language of everything happens for a reason, or you chose this or whatever, is because we want to make it better, right? And they mean well, but often we want to make it better for us because we're uncomfortable with their pain. And that isn't fair, right? Like, we also need to learn to sit in their discomfort. And if they're angry about it, if they don't want to make a meaning out of it right now or ever, then that's okay too. And we can sit in their anger and their hurt instead of trying to help them find a reason for it.
I was just going to say, I was in a class one time. It was like a Native American sacred text class. And the teacher just said something one time that I was like, whoa, that is interesting. I think it was the Navajo corn dance where, so people can handle pain. What they can't handle is pain that has no reason, or like either, you know, like you don't know why you're having pain, or you, it doesn't, you know, it just seems to serve no purpose. And so this particular thing that they would do was to help people find the meeting, but like you were saying, it was like them finding it, not being told what it isn't.
Yeah, and I think that that's the key. Like, if we help people find a meaning in that, we're like, we're curious and we're patient and we hold a space for their grief, that can be incredibly healing. But if we arrive with a prepackaged meaning that we want them to accept, that can be really damaging.
And one of those questions is, for you individually, does this approach, meaning everything happens for a reason, or I chose this, does it promote wellness, or does it promote shame or guilt? That is kind of a good question just to be self-reflective of. Because once again, you get to choose in your meaning. And I think the greatest spiritual violations that many of us have experienced is someone else took our experience and made a meaning for us.
I get to tell my own story. Each of us gets to tell our own story. I hope I can get this out because I don't usually speak in front of people, but I feel a cognitive dissonance in the sense that I sometimes feel like I'm told at church that everything was foreordained, or in the pre-existence, we made this decision, this kind of thing. And then the other thing is free agency. Like, I've always felt more comfortable with the idea that we don't know what's going to happen down there. You're going down there, and it's random. You may have, you know, you may have an easy way, you may have a hard way, but to me, that's dissonant. But often I'll go to church and I'll just be told, or, you know, hear that everything was already decided or foreordained or pre-chosen. Anyway, so that to me, and it's not that I have a solution, it's just very dissonant for me.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of stories like this in Mormonism that have an innate paradox, right? Like, agency and obedience, right? Like, there's an innate paradox there. And that is not something that we as Mormons are comfortable with. Like, we don't want to sit in a paradox. But the truth is life is full of really difficult paradoxes. And when we can learn to manage the paradox, like one of the ones that I see a lot with mixed faith couples is the idea of like my individual needs and the needs of the system or the family, right? Like, there's always going to be a struggle between those two. And there is no way to balance it perfectly or to do it right. And it's the same, I think, with the ideas of obedience and agency. Like, we all believe in freedom and we want people to be make choices, but we also all believe in stoplights, right? And so there is always going to be a tension. And I think our Mormon thinking error is that tension should be solved. There should be a solution, a certain answer. And there isn't. There is just a management of the paradox.
So the book Falling Upward by Richard Rohr really talks about this experience. And I think, I know that your experience is not unique. Like, that real sitting in church and having that cognitive dissonance of, I'm being told one narrative. I'm also being told another narrative that conflicts the first narrative, right? And I think there's this gentleness and freedom that if you're still inhabiting a space of belief and attendance, asking yourself the questions Jen's going to be going over. And once again, taking that authority back and asking yourself about your beliefs. Which one of those serves you?
Yeah, I love these questions. And anytime, like, oh gosh, they're so helpful in so many situations. But it's worth it to examine and challenge our beliefs and our thoughts. It's worth it to change them if they're causing us harm. So really looking, you know, are they unrealistic or irrational? is there any evidence? What are other possible explanations for what happened? So exploring that. What are the implications of my beliefs in this way? And this last one's my favorite. How useful are my beliefs? How useful is this thought? So not so much like whether it's true or not, I think almost, is it useful? Is it helping me? That is really important.
I have a question about the evidence for my beliefs, because that's been brought up several times. I have a question about the evidence for my beliefs, because that's been brought up several times. Isn't sometimes belief means you just believe it when there is no evidence? Like, yeah, so that is kind of a hard thing to say. It almost like challenges that if you can't support it with evidence, then you can't believe it. And that's hard.
Yeah, I think this is, well, what I heard Sarah say in my ear, I think, was that, you know, sometimes using words carefully is not a Mormon strong suit, right? So one of the things, and I think Richard Rohr talks about, is it Richard Rohr? I don't know. There are many, I've read so many books, they all blend together in my head, but about, I think it is Richard Rohr, the difference between belief and faith. So believing something, like I believe that when I go turn on that light switch, the lights will go on or off, right? I believe that based on evidence, because in the past, that has been my experience, right? Faith is more about like the mystery, right? Like those existential angst questions we all ask about, like, is there a God or is there, like, faith is more of like that. There can be no evidence for this, but this is a useful thing for me, and so I'm going to have faith in it, right? Belief is more about like gathering evidence. And I actually, as she was speaking about this, that belief thing made me want to talk a little bit about what does it look like to gather evidence? And I think this is a communal experience, right? Like we cannot figure out what is rational or irrational without help, right? Like that is something we do in community. And in our Mormon community, we're going to have one idea of what is rational and irrational. And in other communities, we're going to have other ideas of what's rational and irrational. And I think when we talk about like figuring out what the evidence is, we often need like to find those two or three special people who we can take our hard things to, that we trust to hold them without judgment and without shaming us, so that we can like bounce off each other. Right? Like we bounce these things off each other. Like, was this irrational? What evidence is there? And we do this together in community. And that is why it is so important for our mental health that we have supportive, loving communities. And for some people, this is going to be Mormonism. And for some people, it isn't. And, you know, checking in with yourself about, are the people that I am bouncing these things off with, is the information they're giving to me useful? Is it helping me to feel happy and move toward my best self? And does it feel true to me?
Also, the permission that we get to choose what we believe, and I think many of us born into a Mormon context never even thought we had that permission. Right? And so once again, where you put your belief and where you put your faith, really just getting really clear of like, how does this serve me? I have seen people within the context of Mormonism, their faith in a higher power or their faith in Christ elevates them to be better people. Like that belief serves them. Right? And even within their Mormonism, they can check other beliefs about the preexistence and say, nope, parts of that don't work for me, or polygamy absolutely does not serve me, right? Like, so I mean, that's the permission of looking at the belief individually, and maybe there isn't evidence in some of those areas, but once again, asking ourselves, is this healthy? Does this help me be a better person? And recognize that a person can be really healthy within a variety of beliefs or disbeliefs. And it's just that personal authority coming back into ourselves. But I think where it's the most dangerous is where we have belief or faith that cannot be proven is then weaponized. right? That's a really dangerous place to be. And I think many of us, that's where some of our greatest wounding comes from, is when someone is telling you that you're wrong when they have no evidence and it's purely based on their belief and faith. Because that is what cognitive dissonance is. It's the belief that what you know to be true no longer fits within the paradigm of what just happened, right? Am I even explaining that right? Cognitive dissonance. How would you describe cognitive dissonance? I mean, what you had once held true and as real no longer serves that space anymore. Or there's evidence of the contrary, whatever that means for you. So I think where religion can get so volatile is we take a belief or a faith in something we cannot prove, like an afterlife, and destroy relationships over it. Does that make sense? Because usually there's a fear associated to it, a fear of not being all or nothing, the safety that comes in that all or nothing, or us against them. So our cognitive distortions, once again, serve us. There is something about believing in the one true church that serves people. And that can be both beautiful and incredibly problematic. And once again, it's about our individual responsibility and knowing what those cognitive distortions are for us in whatever way or not way we're participating, as well as culturally. And so these are the questions we need to ask ourselves. But coming back into ourselves is the first step.
Another example is my best friend, who is amazing, and she's a mother, and she finds so much joy and really feels like that's her calling and loves it. And that's really working for her and not something she needs to challenge. And for me, someone who grew up and always wanted to be a mother, and not having that opportunity yet in my life, I've had to reframe that because that's not useful for me. And that, you know, the evidence kind of showing it was harmful if I start saying, I don't have value, but I do have just as much value. It's just we all have different paths.
Yeah, I was going to say for me, the way that cognitive dissonance arrived, I'll just tell you, was like when I did become a mother and I'd been told my whole life that this would be like the fulfillment of my destiny and I would be so happy and joyful and I really didn't like it, right? Like, and it wasn't that I didn't love my children, but just being a stay-at-home mom was incredibly difficult and painful and traumatizing, in fact, in the midst of sort of being socially isolated and postpartum depression and, right? And so that, like, the dissonance was that story I'd been told my whole life versus the experience I was having, right? Like, so the story and the experience did not line up. And how do you hold that in your head, right?
That is cognitive dissonance. So for protection of time, I gave you a sheet called Putting Thoughts on Trial. If anyone didn't get it, we have some extra. I would love you to take some time if it would serve you to do that at home or with a loved one. It can be really powerful. Like the thought that's really holding you back right now, look at it. And if you're like, I don't even really know I have cognitive distortions, go to where the biggest pain is right now. That thought, I'm not enough. What if the neighbors find out? What if grandma knows that my garments are off? I mean, like whatever that, like that tenderness, that wound, the sticky part is, I want you to think about that thought, because there's usually probably some distortion in it. Our pain can be the example of where the distortion is. But I would like to do some time to have question and answer for the last 15 minutes. Unless you guys want to do I'm going to make the executive decision. Please do the activity on your own and and really give yourself that opportunity. Even if you're like, I'm fine, I'm doing really well in my journey. You still got them, folks. Those distortions come with you, just with a different lens.
Yeah, another way to kind of find those distortions are like the things that either, you know, if you tried to tell someone, you would like start to feel this, like, you know, or the things that, you know, maybe you'd start to cry, or the things that you wouldn't want to say out loud to a group of people. And that isn't to say that that's wrong. Like, you don't need to trust your hard, tender things with everybody.
But usually, if it's too tender to share, there's something there.
I'd like to make a comment here. I do have a PhD in marriage and family, and I've gone through this stuff. But I think the biggest help for me when I was stuck and unhappy was I took a class. I think it was called Advanced Family Living or Adult Living or something. Anyway, we had to test our thoughts for whether they were rational or not, and you had to test them. Does it pass all cultures, all periods of time? I had to throw so much out. I had no idea how Mormon I was and how crazy my thinking was. You would just be shocked if you have to just test everything. Well, is this what all cultures think through all periods of time? I mean, give it a test and see if it holds up. It really helps. Just
your marriage ideas, you know. I mean, just these things you're talking about here today. You say, well, do all people think that?
You know, I mean, those examples that you were giving about how hard life is and that, well, would everybody agree with that? All cultures, all, you know, just take whatever it is you think. Tested that one. It helped me.
I love that. I think one of those truths is that we're all of worth, right? Would most cultures say that every individual has some inherent worth or the right to dignity, right? Like, I mean, I think when we bring it back down, there's a lot of softening and surrender and universality versus the things that we've held on that might have hurt us that we no longer have.
Marriage practices, courtship practices, you know, just.
Thank you.
There's a light in your eyes, in the Mormon eyes. If you've been to another church or anywhere else, lots of people have lights in their eyes. It's not just the Mormon culture, but as a convert, that's what I was like fed a lot.
Right, this countenance, you can see in their countenance that they are either righteous or unrighteous. And then that sort of implies that you can kind of see someone's worthiness through the light in their countenance. So if you are depressed or suffering or in pain, well then, where's that light, man?
I was told one time by a person of authority in the church that I didn't have the Holy Ghost, and that just busted me up, man. That was painful.
I was told I didn't have the Holy Ghost.
I could tell.
That is an example of spiritual abuse, so we just need to name that. That just is what that is. If that's the right definition for you, I think many people would agree, and I'm so sorry that happened. One of the most cognitive dissonance that showed up for me is I was a young woman, young, actively believing, just had gotten married in the temple and went and lived in a leprosy colony in India. And the majority of the children who's had the greatest light I have ever seen didn't even know what a Holy Ghost was. They believed in Ganesh, which is a blue elephant god. Right? And so I was like, how are these people who haven't been in the one true church and that I was supposed to be able to give something to, or that I was supposed to show up in my light, right, have more light than an abundance than I have ever seen? Right? That was the cognitive dissonance. The truth that I was told was not holding up to the truth I was witnessing. But if I shook everything up, like you just recommended, what did I see? I saw the worth of that person in their eyes. I saw the light of whatever is divine or good or true because they're human. And I think those are the moments that start shifting our cognitive distortions. There's a softening there if we can recognize it. But man, the abuse will distort. Abuse solidifies at times and makes our cognitive distortions harder to shake because there's an abuse of power. And when that's done spiritually, the wound is different. And we have to account for that and get healing for that and maybe course correct in ways that are different from that anyone else could tell us.
So just going back to the story that, or the question that you had about if we believe in an abundant God or a God that blesses us, how does that mesh with like cognitive distortions, right? And for me, right, like the way that that meshes is that for me, like there's something about God that gives us that light, that basic worth, and that that isn't something that can be altered, right? Like there's no person in this room, I think, that would look at a line of babies and choose half of them and say, these ones are worthy and these ones are not. Let's throw those ones in the trash, right? Like that would offend our soul, right? And that knowledge that all the babies are valuable, we can think our way out of that. Like people have decided that like the brown babies weren't worth as much, right? Like that is a real thing that happens. But that in our body, that there is something, some knowledge, like a light of Christ or a spirit or a Holy Ghost that can witness that that isn't right, right? That we feel that. And that the abundance of God is about that, about like an intrinsic worth that can't be changed, but not necessarily about like who gets the stuff and who doesn't, if that makes sense.
I was just going to say that I'm kind of glad that you named that spiritual abuse, because I think there's a lot of that goes on and we don't recognize it. And I think we're encouraged to go back into an environment where we are being abused. And I think that demoralization can lead to symptoms of depression, but I wouldn't always necessarily call that a medical depression that needs Prozac. I might say you need to recognize that you're in this abusive situation and recognize that you're going back into it and that your peers are encouraging you to go back into it. So that would be the only other thing I would say, is that I think it would be nice if we recognized the abuse so that we could put a name on it, and then we could deal with it once we named it.
Yeah, we don't have to go to places that aren't safe for us, and we can give ourselves that permission.
I think it's been challenging for us culturally to name spiritual abuse because we've called it chastisement. I think we've named it hard love. What other names have we given it? Righteous judgment. Correction. And I think when we put authority, priesthood, a test. Oh, thank you. I didn't even, a test. This is a test. And I think when we put lay ministers in positions of power with no education and awareness regarding really common human experiences like depression, mental illness, marital challenges, divorce, sexual arousal, there is spaces, because there is no context, that there is abuse that shows up. And spiritual abuse is when someone denies your truth over a truth they've adopted or believe in, and they don't give you space for your own. So I think that also is where we need to be within ourselves. And I echo what Jen says. If church is a spiritually abusive place for you, please make wise choices. The last thing I would say about that is, for those of you who are still attending and find, you know, that complicated joy and yet challenge, I want you to think about the boundaries that you can show up at church. And Wendy Christian, who did a beautiful podcast with Gina Colvin on family enmeshment, has three examples of boundaries. Boundaries that are internal, that are said within oneself. So when someone says over the pulpit hate speech about transgender individuals, there's an immediate boundary within me that I say to myself, that is not okay with me. There's the boundaries that we speak. So we raise our hand in church and say, that hasn't been my experience with depression. Even though we get the daggers in Relief Society. So a boundary we think that we know within ourselves, that we say within ourselves. Boundaries in which we speak, we raise our hand, we have a voice to our partners, to our congregation, to our bishop. It is not okay for you to talk to my son about masturbation. That is a clear spoken boundary. Then there's boundaries upon action or behavioral. That is when someone says something in church that does not work for you, that is spiritually abusive or offensive, you take that boundary and you walk the hell out, right? Or that you set that really clear boundary of a sabbatical, or you set that boundary of, I am not in this conversation any longer, and you leave. So I just want you to know that you can arm yourself with those types of boundaries in every situation, because at church or at conversation with your in-laws or conversations with your parents, we're going to be up against some of these cognitive distortions at all times. We take them with us, they have them with them, and so sometimes what we need to do to protect ourselves has to do with knowing our own cognitive distortions, seeing them in others, and then knowing the boundaries that we need to stay safe.
And tomorrow we're going to be doing a whole session on boundaries, specifically on how to set those in Mormon contexts.
So, would it be possible for you, in a church context, to also have boundaries and go to that person quietly and say, I have a boundary about this and I disagree with you and I'd like to talk it over? I'm reminded of President Hinckley, in another context, they said, why did you change that? He said, somebody talked to us. So one of the things, one of the reaction we could have, forgive me for saying this, is communicate with the person that we have a problem, not flounce out of church, literally and figuratively, or say silently, but if it's big enough deal, to raise your voice and say, I don't agree with that. It may be in Relief Society, and it may be quietly, hopefully, with the person afterwards.
I certainly think that that is a good option, and it was the second option, the middle option she talked about, right? Like that we communicate with someone. There are reasons sometimes where that's either not safe or not effective, right? It, maybe you have communicated in the past over and over again, or your experience with that person is that they don't hear you, or that that isn't, it doesn't feel safe, like there could be social consequences that might. And so it is a good option in many circumstances, but it isn't the only option and the only type of boundary to set. One last thing that I wanted to say on the subject of abuse was that one of the things I see a lot in my clients is this, after being in situations that were abusive, blaming yourself for not seeing it sooner or not setting a boundary sooner or not having the skills to get out of that situation. And one of the things I want to say is that when we are bringing this gentleness, we need to, and this peace that we want to create, we need to bring it to ourselves as well. There is a thing that I like to call like trauma blindness. Like often we do not see things as abuse because it isn't safe for us to see. We will see it when it becomes safe for us to see. And we did the best we could to see, and we did the best to take care of ourselves that we could. But sometimes there are social pressures, there are financial pressures that make it so that those abusive situations continue because we wouldn't be safe if we spoke up or spoke out. And so it isn't helpful or useful to blame yourself for not having taken steps sooner or not having put in boundaries sooner, because you put those in place and you use those tools when it is safe to do so. And we were all doing the best we could.
Yes, absolutely. The comment was, it's understandable to have those feelings. Those shoulda, woulda, coulda still show up, right? And that's why sometimes it can be really helpful to work through those. Thank you so much for your comments and your time.
Yeah, it's 6:30 actually. Just a few things. I want to thank the presenters. I think we all feel enriched for having been here. So, and thank you for being here as they think too. And one thing, I need to do a little self-correction publicly. I apologize for speaking disparagingly about a Utah icon, Crown Burger, and I'm kind of a foodie. And so I forget sometimes it's about community. It's getting together at Crown Burger is about being in community with our fellow Sunstone attendees. It's not about the quality of the food necessarily, which may be great. I've never eaten there. So
thank you so much.